the witch dropped her arm and came back to strut and preen in front of Robin. Then again she shrieked, whirled and rushed at Juba. This time she struck, and the tail hissed and snapped on black flesh. But at the very last second, the witch had diverted her aim, and the blow flew into the startled face of the young woman who stood beside Juba.
"I smell evil!" shrieked the witch,
and the woman fell to her knees.
"I smell blood!"
The witch struck again and again, the tail cutting stingingly into the woman's unprotected face until the tears started and ran down her cheeks. The executioners came forward and pulled her to her feet. The woman's legs were paralysed, so they dragged her unprotesting before Lobengula. And he looked down on her, saddened and helplessly compassionate, before he lifted the forefinger of his right hand. One of the executioners swung his war club, a full blow that stove in the back of the woman's skull. The bone crunched like a footstep in loose gravel, and the woman's eyes were driven from their sockets like overripe grapes by the force of it. When she fell face forward in the dust, there was a bloodless depression in the back of her head into which a man could have placed his fist. The witch scurried away to continue the hunt, and Juba looked across at Robin. Robin had fallen back on her chair, trembling and pale, while Clinton put an arm around her shoulders to steady her. In the packed ranks, there was another triumphant shriek, and the executioners dragged a fine-looking young warrior from his place. He threw off their hands and strode to drop on one knee before Lobengula's throne.
"Father of the nation, hear my praises. Great Thunderer, Black Bull, let me die with your name on my lips. O Lobengula who drives like the wind."
The king lifted his finger, and the club fell with the flute of a goose's wing. The chorus of howls and shrieks was unending now, as the sisters warmed to their work, and the victims were dragged out and slaughtered until their corpses were a high mound before the king's throne, a tangle of black limbs and shattered heads that grew and grew. 100, 200 were added to the pile, while the sun reached its zenith, and the dust and heat and terror formed a suffocating miasma, and the blue metallic flies swarmed in the staring eyes and open mouths of the dead, and the witches cavorted and giggled and struck with their rods. Here and there a maiden, overcome with the fear and the blazing heat, fell swooning from her place, and the witches pounced upon this irrefutable evidence of guilt and rained blows upon her bare back or glossy breasts, and the executioners hurried to keep pace with their dreadful task. The sun began its slow descent towards the western horizon, and at last, one at a time, the witches crept back to the mountain of death they had created. They staggered with exhaustion. The dust had caked on their running sweat, but they bayed and whined like dogs as they pored over the corpses, selecting those they would take with them back to their caves and secret places. A sliver of the womb of a virgin was a powerful fertility charm. A slice of the heart of a blooded warrior was a wonderful talisman in battle.
"Is the work done?" Lobengula asked.
"It is done, O king. Are the evil ones dead?"
"They are all dead, son of Mzilikatsi."
"Then go. And go in peace," Lobengula said wearily.
"Stay in peace, great king."
They chuckled and hooted, and bearing their gruesome plunder with them, they shuffled away through the gateway of the stockade. Three times in as many weeks, Mungo St. John petitioned the king, asking him to give the road to the south. But each time the king chatted affably for an hour and then waved him away.
"I will think of it, one bright eye, but are you unhappy here? Does the beef and beer I send you not fill your belly? Perhaps you would like to go once again on the hunt."
"I want to go south, O king."
"Perhaps in the next full moon, one bright eye. And then again, perhaps after the rain has passed or after the Chawala ceremony, who knows? We will see in good season."
Then one morning Louise rode out early, as had become her custom. But after she had been gone some hours, Mungo realized that this time she had the rifle and bandolier of ammunition, her blanket roll, and the gallon water bottle with her. He puzzled over her behavior for the rest of that day. But he was not alarmed until night fell, and she had not returned. He sat up beside the fire all that night, and at first light he took the second mule and crossed the river to where Rudd's party was camped in grand style in a pleasant glade of the forest. They had 6 wagons and as many tents made of best quality waterproof canvas, each with sun fly sheets. The horses on the picket line were all blood Arabs, one of which would carry Mungo and his small bag of precious stones to the Shashi River in 6 days or less. He was eyeing them hungrily when Robin Codrington stooped out of one of the tents. She saw him and would have gone in again, but he called to her and jumped down from the mule. "Dr. Codrington, please, it is a matter of extreme urgency." Reluctantly, she turned back. "My wife is missing. She did not come in last night." Immediately, her distant expression changed to one of concern. "Did she say where she was going?" He shook his head. "I can only think that she might have ridden back to Kami. You know she was becoming friendly with your elder daughter. I shall send a servant to the mission. Can you not ask the king to let me go?" "The king has gone in to his wives. Nobody, not even I, dare disturb him until he comes out from the women's quarters." "How long will that be?" "A day, a week? There is no way of telling. I shall send word to you as soon as I have news." That night, Mungo waited again. And then in the dawn, as he crouched, haggard and blary-eyed, over the smoky fire, listening for the hoof-beats of the mule or the sound of Louise's voice out of the darkness, he was struck instead by a thought that chilled his blood and made his guts slide with dread. He leapt up from the fire, ran into the hut, and scrabbled frantically under the mattress. With a blessed soaring relief, his fingers closed on the bag, and he pulled it out and fumbled the drawstring open. He poured the bright stones into the palm of his hand. They were all there, but with them was something that had not been there before. It was a folded sheet of paper, and he took it to the fire and held it to catch the light. "When you find this, you will know why I have gone. Even as I write this, the memory of those poor wretches who died in their hundreds to pay for your greed rises before me to torment me. With them died the last of my love for you. I leave you those blood-spattered stones in the certain knowledge that they are accursed. Do not follow me. Do not send after me. Do not think of me again." She had not signed it. Rudd's party was at breakfast under the open-sided dining tent. It was a fresh and cool morning. The conversation around the table was intelligent, informed, and yet quick and witty. Robin revelled in it. She sat at the head of the trestle table, and the gentleman deferred to her. Mr. Rudd had been very obviously taken with her from their first meeting, and addressed all his remarks to her directly. Jordan had supervised the preparation of a gargantuan English breakfast. Fresh eggs and grilled gammon, salted kippers, and tinned pork sausage, potted shrimps and bloater paste, with freshly churned yellow butter and hot scones. Mr. Rudd, quite carried away with the spontaneous festive mood, called for a bottle of champagne that had been hung overnight in a wet sack to cool. "Well," he lifted his glass to Robin, "I am sure we shall be able to survive this rough life and rude fare until the good king makes up his mind." Despite Robin's intercession, Lobengula had not yet ratified the concession that they sought. His senior in Dunas had been in secret conclave for weeks, but could not reach a consensus of agreement. While Lobengula vacillated and reacted to Mr. Rudd's insistence by retiring to his women's quarters where nobody could reach him. "It may take months yet," Robin lifted her own glass and returned Rudd's salute. "I would not expect Lobengula to make a decision on such an important matter without going into the Matopus Hills to consult the oracle, the Amlima." Suddenly, Clinton looked down towards the river, frowned, and whispered to Robin. "It's that scoundrel St. John. What does he want coming here?" Mungo St. John had dismounted at the periphery of the camp, but he did not approach the company under the open-sided marquee. Robin stood up quickly. "Please excuse me, gentlemen. General St. John's wife is missing, and he is naturally worried." "Thank you for coming," Mungo said. She hurried to him. "I have nobody else to turn to, Robin." She tried to ignore the intimacy of his appeal, and the little jolt that his use of her given name always gave her. "Do you have any news?" she asked. "I have discovered a note that Louise left for me." "Let me see it," Robin held out her hand. "I am sorry, it contains most personal and, I fear, embarrassing references," Mungo told her. "But what is important is that Louise is trying to leave Matabeleland by the southern road." "That is madness," Robin whispered. "Without the king's permission, without an escort, the road is obscure, the country wild and infested with lions. She cannot hope to pass the border impis, and they have orders to kill all who do not have the road from Lobengula." "She knows all this," Mungo said. "Then what possessed her to make the attempt?" "We argued. She resented the feeling which she knows that I still have for you." Robin fell back a pace, her cheeks paling and her breath catching in her throat. "General St. John, I forbid you to talk in that fashion. You asked me, Robin, and once, long ago, I told you that I would never forget that night aboard Huron." "Stop it! Stop it this instant! How can you speak like this when your wife is in dire danger?" "Louise was never my wife," he said quietly, staring into her green eyes with that single penetrating gaze. "She was my travelling companion, never my wife." Robin faltered. Colour rushed back into her cheeks, and with it came a strange, unaccountable pagan joy. You told me once that you were married." "I was, Robin, not to Louise. That other lady died many years ago in Navarre, in France." Robin confounded herself. "She was married to a brave, kind man, in his own way a saintly man, while before her stood the embodiment of evil, the veritable serpent of Eden. And yet she could not suppress this wicked, unconscionable elation at the knowledge that he was free. Free for she knew not what, or could not bring herself to think on it. I shall go to the king," she said, painfully aware of the quaver in her voice. I shall ask him to send men after the lady. I shall ask him also to give you the road, General, and I would consider it full repayment if you would take it immediately and never return to Matabeleland." "What is between us can never be denied, Robin, as long as we both live. I do not wish to see you again." With an effort of all her will, she steadied her voice and met his eye. "Robin, I shall send a messenger to you with the king's reply." "Robin, please," her voice cracked again. "In God's holy name, please leave me alone." However, it was two more days before Robin sent Jordan Ballantyne to Mungo's camp. "Dr. Codrington bids me tell you, sir, that the king has already sent one of his trusted indunas with a picked body of warriors after your wife. They have orders to protect her from the border guards and to escort her to the Shashi River." "Thank you, young man. Furthermore, she asked me to tell you that the king has given you the road. You may follow your wife immediately. Again, my thanks to Dr. Codrington. General St. John, you do not remember me." I am afraid..." Mungo frowned up at Jordan on the back of the dancing Arab mare. "Jordan, Zuga Ballantyne's son. We met in Kimberley some years ago." "Ah, of course, forgive me. You have changed." "General, I know that it is none of my business, but as you are a trusted friend of my father's, it is my duty to warn you that there were unpleasant rumours after your departure from Kimberley." "I did not know," Mungo told him indifferently. "Still, it is one of life's unpleasant truths that the more prominent a man becomes, the more determined are the mean little men to tear him down." "I know that, General. I am associated with a great man," Jordan checked himself. "However, a police agent, a Griqua named Hendrik Nyman, claimed that you attended an IDB rendezvous and that when you realized it was a trap, you attempted to kill him." Mungo made an impatient gesture. "Why should somebody of my standing, my estate, take such a ridiculous risk as to indulge in IDB? "That was what Mr. Rhodes said, sir. He has repeatedly expressed certainty of your innocence. After I have found my wife, I shall return immediately to Kimberley to confront this Nyman person." General St. John, that will be neither necessary nor possible. Nyman was killed some months ago in a knife fight in one of the drinking canteens. He cannot give evidence for or against you. Without either witness or accuser, your innocence is presumed.
Damn it! Mungo frowned to cover his immense relief. I should have welcomed the chance to force his words down his lying throat. Now there will always be doubts in some men's minds.
Only in the minds of the mean little men, Jordan touched the brim of his cap. I shall not detain you further. You must be anxious to follow and find your wife. Good luck and Godspeed. I am sure we shall meet again, General.
Mungo St. John stared after Jordan as he rode away. It was hard to grasp the extent of his good fortune. The spectre of unrelenting justice that had pursued him from the south had vanished. He had the road to leave Matabeleland, and an immense fortune in diamonds to carry with him.
An hour later, he had visited one of the traders and exchanged the cart and the other meagre possessions he no longer needed for a good rifle and 100 rounds of ammunition. And he sat the broad, comfortable back of the mule, its head pointed southwards as it skirted the granite hills of the Indunas. Mungo looked neither left nor right. His eye was fixed ahead, towards the south, so that he did not see the slim, almost boyish figure on the slopes high above him. Robin shaded her eyes with the brim of her bonnet and peered after him until the little feather of dust raised by the mule's big, heavy hooves subsided into the mimosa forests. Louise St. John was driven on by her need to keep ahead of any pursuit, obsessed with the knowledge that she must avoid the kraals along the road, ridden by the guilt she knew she must share with Mungo, her senses and emotions in terrible turmoil, so that she did not have a chance to regret her hasty action, taken in the shock of discovering the diamonds, nor did she realize the depths of her loneliness, until she had successfully skirted the last of the great kraals and left the pleasant grasslands of the plateau. Now, ahead of her, the escarpment fell into the wild land, hot and heavily forested, which she knew was teeming with wild animals and guarded by the merciless border impis. It was a measure of her desperate need to be free of Mungo St. John and all he stood for that she never once considered turning back, though she knew there was sanctuary for her at Carmi Mission, though she knew that Robin Codrington would go to the king on her behalf, and he would give her an escort of warriors to the border. She could not go back. She could not bear the prospect of being close to Mungo St. John ever again. The love she had once borne him had sickened into total revulsion. No risk was too high to escape him, and she had to do it now. There was no going back. She lay the last night beside the wagon ruts that were her tenuous link with civilization and life itself, her own thread through the maze of the Matabele Minotaur, and she listened to the mule cropping grass close at hand, and far away down the escarpment the faint roar of a hunting lion, while she tried to reconstruct in her mind the map that had formed the frontispiece to Zuga Ballantyne's book, A Hunter's Odyssey. The account of Zuga's journeys had fascinated her, even before she had met him, and she had studied the map with minute attention. She judged that from where she now lay, the Tati River was not more than 100 miles due west. No pursuer would expect her to take that direction. No impi would guard that desolate, untravelled quarter. And the Tati River was the border between Matabeleland and Karma's country. By all accounts, King Karma was a gentle and honourable man. His country was under the suzerainty of the British Crown, and British justice was ensured by the presence of Sir Sidney Shippard at Karma's kraal. If she could reach the Tati River and follow it south until she met some of Karma's people who could take her to Sir Sidney, then he would see to it that she was sent on southwards to Kimberley.